from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the lesser-known parts of Harriet Tubman's life. Author Erica Armstrong Dunbar has taken a fresh look at the extraordinary woman who led slaves to freedom on the Underground Railroad. Dunbar's new book is titled, She Came to Slay. Then at 10:30, a tribute to the artists and culture keepers in the Bay Area through a new podcast from KQED called Right Nowish. Host Pendarvis Harshaw and producer Ashley Ann Krigbaum will tell us about the artists and innovators they've met who are shaping our region right now-ish. Join us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We turn now to the life of one of the best-known black women in U.S. history, Araminta Ross. And if you didn't know that Araminta was Harriet Tubman's birth name, that's the point. Little is known about Tubman outside her extraordinary work as the conductor of the Underground Railroad that led enslaved people to freedom. So writer and historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar is changing that with her new book on Tubman titled She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. Welcome to Forum, Erica Armstrong Dunbar.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. I'm wondering if you could start by reading the introduction to your book, just to remind us of the incredible fortitude of this woman most of us learned about in elementary history textbooks as Harriet Tubman.
Sure. I'll start with the intro just to give a bit of a taste. It wasn't just Harriet who would need grit. Her fugitive followers would need it, too. We can only imagine the orientation Harriet gave the runaways, how she prepared them for what to expect. Her methods had to have been effective, because on her previous trips, nothing had gone wrong. But this time, one runaway lost his nerve. A group of fugitives followed Harriet into the cold swamps of Maryland's eastern shore, where they hid during the daylight hours. At night, they traveled north, all the while trying to ignore their empty stomachs and deteriorating faith. The journey had taken its toll on the group, but one man in particular was broken by the terror and fatigue. He announced that he would return to the farm and take his chances on the punishment he would likely face. He refused to listen to the other fugitives in his party, who begged him to continue on with them. The frigid nights, the wet clothes, the fear, and the thirst wore the man down. He refused to move another step, provoking a standoff between himself and the group's leader. Harriet could not let one man endanger the lives of the entire group. He was the weak link in the chain of co-conspirators who now knew the route that Harriet used to rescue her fugitives. She was certain that severe punishment could easily pry this information from his lips. Harriet said, quote, "If he was weak enough to give out, he'd be weak enough to betray us all, and all who had helped us. And do you think I'd let so many die just for one coward man?" End quote. She had to protect herself and the others, so she did what needed to be done. Harriet approached the man, aimed a revolver at his head, and told him that he had a decision to make. He could keep moving, or he could die. Harriet would kill this man before letting him jeopardize her operation. Not only did she have the well-being of the other fugitives on her mind, but she also thought about the other family members she had yet to rescue. If she had to, she would kill him and bury his body in the woods.
Erica Armstrong Dunbar reading from her book, She came to slay about the life and times of Harriet Tubman. And of course, Eric Armstrong Dunbar, that fugitive kept going.
Yes, he looked at her in the eyes. He knew she was serious and kept moving.
And also just the title, She Came to Slay, really enlivens it with that story. But also, I mean, you know, Slay, it's a reference to Beyonce. It's got this sort of pop culture ring to it. So you have sort of this mashup of academic research and contemporary culture. Why it this way?
Yeah, that was the plan. I mean, when I originally talked with my editor about writing this book, and we knew that the Tubman film, of course, would come out this fall of 2019, we kind of thought about, you know, what I was asked, you know, do you want to write this biography? And I thought about it for a while, and I said, what can I bring to this body of literature? There actually aren't a significant number of adult biographies about Tubman. There are lots of sort of children's books, but I wanted to sort of immediately bring a more modern and contemporary, to fashion her more modern and contemporary than we've seen in the past, to bring readers to be able to connect the past to the present. So the title, She Came to Slay, was hopefully, as well as sort of illustrations and photos and call-outs in the book, was an attempt to bring a sort of more modern rendering of Tubman to readers.
Yes, and the image on the cover of the book, Tubman is holding a gun, which is very different from the images of the woman with a headscarf and her hands clasped that we're used to seeing of Harriet Tubman.
Yeah, no, and that was sort of purposeful. I think that one of the things I wanted to do in the book was to show a complicated, multidimensional Tubman, not just the elderly woman, head covered, hands clasped, head bowed, the picture that you typically see in your high school history textbook at some point, or during Black History Month. I wanted to think about Tubman as a younger person, as a young woman, and one who did what she needed to do in order to rescue the dozens of people that she did from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And she needed a gun for many reasons.
Do you think those images of Tubman that we see in history books were deliberate just to make her more palatable?
Yes, yes and no. I mean, I think that part of, you know, what we know about Tubman, or at least the images that we have of her up until recently, have been images of her as an older woman. Now, of course, that does make her less threatening, more palatable to present an older woman, to only kind of recognize her as this conductor on the Underground Railroad. It's safe, you know, and it's true as well. But when Tubman was on the Underground, she wasn't in her 70s. You know, she was a younger woman. She was born in 1822, and she escapes in 1849, so she's 27, and she spends really the next 9 years. So she's a younger woman when she is walking through the swamps of the Eastern Shore of Maryland and leading people to Philadelphia and then to Canada.
Yes, so let's talk about some of the lesser known aspects of Tubman's life and what signs that you saw from her as a young child that told you that she would end up with the incredible courage to do what she did.
Yeah, you know, I made the decision actually to start the book not with Araminta Ross's sort of birth. I made the decision to go back further and to connect her to her African ancestry. And so the book really begins with her grandmother, who was named Modesty, who arrived on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, colonial Maryland, sometime in the mid to late 18th century. We don't know. And I wanted actually to be able to draw this connection between the strength of those who were able to survive the Middle Passage, who made it from Africa eventually to colonial Maryland, and to draw that connection through her mother and then to Araminta. At the age of 5 years old, Araminta was hired out to work, really sort of removed from her family. And so I want readers to sort of think about this. We don't, of course, have images of her. And so instead, I've used illustrations to sort of fashion what she looked like as a child. But she was 5 or 6 years old, not yet with her adult teeth. And she's separated and forced to do some really sort of difficult labor. She's first charged with emptying the muskrat traps of her new owner's farm. And so she would wade in the sort of frigid waters of off of Maryland and empty these traps with little hands and remove the dead rodents. And she would do domestic work and she would care for infants. She was so small, she had to sit on the ground in order to hold the babies because she wasn't strong enough. And every time they cried, especially at night, her mistress, her owner, would whip her about her head and her neck. And so this is the life of slavery that enslaved children experienced very early on, and Araminta was no different.
We're talking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's a writer, historian, and lecturer at Charles and Mary Beard, a Charles and Mary Beard Professor of History at Rutgers University. And we're talking about her book, She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. There's also a new biopic about Harriet Tubman just out last week. And so I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation with any questions you might have about Harriet Tubman, maybe what Harriet Tubman's story means to you or what you've always wondered about her. The number 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your questions and comments on Facebook. You can tweet us at KQED Forum or email us at forum@kqed.org. The other thing that I was struck by was just also the detail that you gave about when she was struck in the head and how that ended up not only saddling her with incredibly painful headaches, but also epileptic seizures, and that while she's running this Underground Railroad, she was aware that she could even at times lose consciousness along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't often think about or look at Tubman through the lens of disability, but she did indeed struggle with physical disabilities sometime between the ages of 12 and 14. She went for on an errand to the store, to the local store, and sort of encountered a scene that she wasn't expecting. There was an overseer from another farm who was sort of chasing down another enslaved man. We don't know if he was attempting to escape the farm or if he had broken some rule, but he was attempting to capture this man, and they all end up in the store at the same time. The overseer tells Araminta to help him to grab a hold of this man, and she refuses to do so. And because of that, he escapes. The overseer is so angry, he picks up a 2-pound metal weight, and he hurls it in the direction, we believe, of the runaway. But instead, it collides with Araminta's skull. It literally fractures her skull, and she's rendered unconscious. She's bleeding profusely, and she tells later on in her life how she's taken back to her quarters. She has no bed to lay on, so they lay her on the bench of a weaving loom, and she's forced very soon to go back to kind of hard agricultural labor. And she talks about being in the fields, unable to see, that the blood is sort of dripping down her eyes, her face. And this begins really a lifetime of physical ailments. She would fall into, she called them sleeping spells. Probably today we would call them epilepsy or epileptic seizures. And she really would be rendered unconscious. She would not be roused until she was ready. And, you know, while this could happen at any moment. And so the vulnerability of that as an enslaved person is we have to sort of think about that. That was grave. But there was a sort of upside to this damaging sort of the violence of slavery. And that was, she said that this connected her to God. Tubman was a deeply spiritual person. And she said it was during these sleeping spells that she would have visions and a connection to God. And these visions and connections would actually help lead her in directions that would save her fugitives that she was helping to escape later on, and herself. So with the trauma, there came the triumph of this connection with God.
Mm. Well, let me go to caller Ron in Benicia. Hi, Ron. Join us.
Hey, good morning. I saw the movie with my daughter I came away with it was a powerful movie, and the lady, I sorry I didn't get in right on the beginning, I don't know her name, but the professor you have there, her storyline tracks with and explains the truth of some of the movie I saw there, particularly about the gentleman who wanted to turn around and go back. Powerful scene. But let me just say that I came away with this takeaway. I asked my daughter, first of all, what does she think? She hesitated for a while, and then she said, strong women. And she said a few other things. And then I said to her, what I came away from this movie was with, women do not need men for protection. All they need for protection is belief in God, a good common sense, and the courage to follow the common sense. Powerful. And this, the professor just mentioned the second thing I came away with this morning thinking about is this religious aspect of the movie. Very powerful, very within the scope of traditional African American feelings and thoughts and religion. And man, I'm thinking, professor and host there, Nina Kim, if we could come back to those strong beliefs in God, who knows what the future would be for us? That's all I want to say. That's a beautiful movie. And ma'am, thank you for the book. I will be getting that book.
Ron, thanks for sharing your thoughts. I don't know, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, if you wanted to respond to Ron at all.
Yeah, no, I think most people are sort of, I think the universal feeling walking out of the film is that, you know, it's a story about not necessarily just about slavery, but this was a film about freedom. And, you know, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't sort of mention the fact that this is a film that was in part written, directed, executive produced by Black women. And I think that's important to mention. When we're thinking about the voice of the story, the feeling, the craft, the score was, of course, done by a Black man. And then me, you know, just sort of writing this biography of Tubman as a Black academic, I think that it does sort of lend to a different fashioning of her. And I like how he said, he talked about strength and she needed her God and only her God. And I would say that she needed her God and her gun.
Well, thanks. And let me go to Jennifer in Oakland next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, good morning. That was a funny comment. Yes, she needed her God and her gun. I'm calling from Oakland, California. Thank you so much for this interview and for writing this wonderful book. Mm-hmm. I've been a fan of Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, all of these wonderful major figures in American history, I'll say, for all of my life since I've learned about them. But I was always left wanting because we had the same set of serial pictures, black and white pictures that really weren't very relatable. And it wasn't until there was a scene, it still gives me chills, from the series Underground on Netflix, where the actress who portrayed Harriet Tubman, the whole episode was about her addressing her supporters, who were mostly not Black. And it was so, I'm still, my voice is shaking because it was so powerful. I'm just grateful that these characters from history who did so much for this country by liberating enslaved people, it benefited all of us, that now they're coming in, almost coming in as like pop heroes or superheroes. And she definitely was a superhero to me. So I just want to thank you both for shining the light on this wonderful woman.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, thank you. Jennifer's point is also reminding me of the story that I learned from your book, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, that she was the first woman in U.S. history to plan and lead an armed expedition. And, you know, we credit her with the 70 or so people along the Underground Railroad that she led to freedom. But this expedition liberated some nearly 750 enslaved people.
Yeah, I know. It's one of the, you know, who knew? There's comments that people say, I had no idea about that with Tubman. But yeah, she was, you know, in 1862, she's actually called upon by the governor of Massachusetts to go down to South Carolina and to basically serve as a spy and a scout for the Union Army. And, you know, I think it's important for us to note that at this moment, Tubman is still technically a fugitive, because the Emancipation Proclamation had not yet happened. And even when it did in 1863, it only emancipated those people in states that had seceded from the Union. Maryland had not. And so technically, when Tubman makes the decision to head down to Buford, South Carolina, to serve as a spy and a scout. She's doing this as a fugitive. She's still not yet free. And so she's the perfect person to go. If anyone knew how to spy and scout, it was Tubman, who made 13 at least successful trips back and forth between the eastern shore of Maryland to the north. And she gets down there and she's able to do just that. She's, in addition to being a spy and a scout, she's a nurse in the army camps. She's an entrepreneur. She's doing everything that she can. But what she's most well known for is leading basically a battalion of men, mostly black male soldiers, to beyond Confederate lines and to up the Combahee River in June of 1863 and liberating over 750 enslaved people. So when we tally the numbers, we can. It is sort of a close to 1,000 people that Tubman directly liberated.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I did want to ask you. So President Barack Obama said that Harriet Tubman's face would be on the $20 bill by 2020. Later, the Trump administration announced that they would not make that change, and they cited technical reasons for it, though Trump has also made comments about it being political correctness to put Tubman on the $20 bill and that he's a fan of President Andrew Jackson. I wonder what you make of what's happened with that effort?
Yeah. No, I think that there was sort of a great deal of interest in having Tubman on the bill. And I think sort of a symbolic measure to have a black woman on U.S. currency, I think, is important. But I would also suggest that we need to have a very deep conversation about what it means to put the face of an enslaved person, a person who at some point had a value, a monetary value, attached to her own body, a woman who had bounties placed on her head. What does it mean to take this woman and put her on the bill? And of course, that's not saying we shouldn't put her on the bill. It's saying that I think it's the first step. Putting her face on the bill, having her likeness on currency, will hopefully have us ask deeper questions about the vestiges of slavery and where and how we still see them today.
Mm. Good point. Well, let me end with Julie, who writes, I'm so excited that we're experiencing a time of a more open, truthful exploration of the slave experience in the U.S. My high school English class just finished reading The Narrative Life of Frederick Douglass, and we explored the 1619 Project. I didn't know that She Came to Slay was available, but I will read it now and get ready to have the class explore it. Nothing like these offerings were available or even approached in class during my high school years in northern Louisiana in the 80s. Erica Armstrong Dunbar, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the book is She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. I'm Mina Kim, Mora Forum. Stay with us.